I never wanted to be a trumpet player. So, but the reason why I didn't is because I never saw myself represented in the music. Like I never saw women perform and thought, oh, I could do that. In fact, I was in my first or second year of my production degree. So I was going to be a sound engineer and a producer. That there was an all-female jazz quintet came to this small town, and they had to sort of move the pool table to in this pub to fit the band in. And I remember just thinking, oh, I didn't know we could do that, you know.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. The Australian-born trumpeter-composer Nadia Nordhaus is renowned for her playing, composition, and teaching, and in this conversation, you'll hear her reflect on all three. As well as her own projects, she regularly tours with several ensembles, including the Maria Schneider Orchestra, Darcy James Argue's Secret Society, and the Anat Cohen Tentet. Nadia's unique blend of experience, empathy, and humor has made her a sought-after educator, having honed her skills in teaching individualized lessons based on pedagogy of her brass mentor, Laurie Frink. She also spoke candidly about some challenges she's faced as a woman across the music industry, as well as how she overcame some serious challenges in her student years. I'm a big fan of her music, and you'll be hearing a few clips throughout the episode. The track names and albums are detailed in the timestamps. You can watch the video on my YouTube or listen to the podcast, and I've also linked the transcript. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the show notes of this episode on my website, where you'll find all the links, including different ways to support this podcast and other episodes you'll enjoy. Hey, Nadia, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thanks for having me.
I found out about you from Sarah Caswell.
Excellent.
Yeah, when she was on this podcast, I can't remember, maybe 2 years ago, and her composition, South Shore, from one of her albums.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I loved it. Not her composition, your composition.
Yep.
And I loved it so much. And I was like, who's this composer? She said, oh, Nadia's a friend of mine. She's great. And then since then, I started listening to your music and following you. So that was that connection.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I wrote that for her quite some time ago. So it's like one of these tunes that sort of had been on the shelf for a long time. So it was nice to have it dusted off and recorded.
Yeah. So I'm curious about your Dutch family connection, because you have a Dutch name.
I have a very Dutch name. It's a shame because I don't actually speak any Dutch. I feel a little bit like a fake Dutch person. But my father's Dutch. He came to Australia when he was a kid. So.
Okay.
That's where that comes from.
So it is Nordhaus.
Nordhaus, yes.
Yeah. I do speak some Dutch.
Do you?
My elder daughter lives in Rotterdam. She's been there for many years.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I started learning a bit because it's fun when you visit a place to know a little bit.
Absolutely. I have visited quite a number of times, and whenever I try and speak Dutch, they just sort of answer back in English. You know, they can tell immediately.
Yeah.
That I'm struggling.
So I thought maybe we could start with Multitudes, your latest album with James Shipp. You guys have such a beautiful artistic partnership.
Thank you. We decided to record Multitudes as a follow-up to Indigo. So Indigo was our first record, and it was quite a number of years between the two records, and we thought, wouldn't it be fun to just have a bunch of layers of ourselves. So really recording something that we couldn't recreate live was our sort of interesting goal. I think this is sort of common these days, but when sort of collaborating when you're in different places, you know, sort of throwing ideas into a Dropbox and sort of going back and forth is something that we did for a while, and then we would get together and work out a few things, and then he would record some synth parts along. And then actually when we went into the studio, we had quite a bit already recorded. So then we would go in and record some more layers, and then record even more layers on top of that. So I think at one point we were both overdubbing at the same time. I think I was playing recorder and he was playing sleigh bells. And at the end of the take, he said, we're not reporting to anyone, are we? Because it was just, you know, we've worked together for so long that we can sort of, we sort of encourage each other's crazy, you know. So we'd listen to something and we're like, oh, yeah, like church hall choir. We're like, we sort of speak in this kind of code. We're like, yeah. You know, like boy choir, yeah, recorders, yes, you know. So that's what sort of Multitudes was all about.
I think a clip maybe from something like Run Together, because you this interesting use of percussion. And maybe speak to who James is for people that aren't familiar with him.
So James Shipp is a vibraphone player who also plays percussion and synthesizers, and often at the same time. So he's sort of unusual in that respect. A very unique human being, very funny, very witty, very smart, and a great person to be able to play music with.
And you do perform live sometimes.
We do, and actually, if I could speak about Run Together, we were actually commissioned in the pandemic by this person in England that we didn't know, who wanted us to write music to her partner's artwork as a birthday gift. So she sent through, you know, maybe like 8 artworks. And so at the time I was in Australia and James was in Brooklyn. And so again, it was sort of this sort of Dropbox idea where, you know, I would look at the artwork and write some music and then he would respond. And so we sort of went back and forth. And so that's where Run Together came in. So that was actually based on some artwork.
Yeah. That's a cool commission to get.
It really was. It was just sort of out of the blue, and we were just like, oh, we've never done anything like this. We'll give it a go. You know, never say no.
So. Well, I really love the album. There's so many interesting tracks and textures and unexpected things. But I have to say, you know, you're known for your lyrical writing and playing, and To Say Goodbye is such a beautiful ballad.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm trying to think, how would I come up with that one? I think it's just one of these things that I just sort of sit and I don't think I have an interesting story about it other than like I just sort of like sit and think and try and sometimes I pretend like I'm Pat Metheny. What would Pat Metheny write, you know, especially when it comes to like ballad writing, you know, so I think I was just trying to write something beautiful, you know.
I was wondering if you wanted to talk about the loss of your dear friend Lois Martin recently.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, Lois and I had been friends since her partner's passing. Her partner was my teacher, Laurie Frank. And we became friends. Really, it was like the next day or the day after, it was sort of, you know, funnily enough, with Sarah Caswell, Sarah invited me to a lunch that was happening at Lois's place. Sarah was part of the string. Sarah and Lois and some others were the string group for Esperanza Spalding's Chamber Music Society. So they were all gathered together, and me. And so I knew Laurie and no one else knew Laurie, but I didn't know Lois, and everyone else knew Lois but not Laurie. So it was sort of this weird, it's sort of like weird combination. But I just figured I was there to help Lois do whatever she needed to do to memorialize and sort of keep Laurie's legacy alive. And that's exactly what happened. So I helped, you know, run the grant in Laurie's name. We award $10,000 every 2 years to an up-and-coming brass player. And then we just became, good friends. I rented a Laurie's studio in her apartment to teach out of once a week. And so then I would go over and then, you know, inevitably it turned into dinner and sitting on the couch for hours chatting, and then I would go back to Brooklyn. So in the pandemic, I ended up staying with her at her cabin upstate. I thought I was going to be up there for a couple of weeks, and I was there for 7 months. So we became very close, and then I went back to Australia for a while, and then when I moved back to New York, I moved into the back room of her apartment. So, yeah, she was a very, very close friend and a dear friend. She had some health problems for a couple of years, but it's, she was a person that I texted every day. So it's been a little bit unusual to have, you know, just in this last month, like, you know, something will happen, or, you know, and I want to text her and, you know, I can't. So, it's a big loss for sure.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Are there things you'd like people to know about Lois as a musician or a person?
I mean, so many people know of Lois as like an incredible violist. And especially a violist that if there's like a jazz record with strings, she's on it. So Chris Potter, Michael Brecker, Esperanza Spalding. Yeah, she was part of a really fantastic project, one of her last projects actually, with Ryan Truesdell, who recorded, I think it was 17 commissions by jazz composers for string quartet. So she was part of that epic recording. I think it's like a multi-disc recording. Yeah, so many people know her of that, but I know her more, even though I was obviously around her and would hear her practicing, I know her more as a person, just sort of like her sort of vivaciousness and just when people think of her, they just think of her incredible spirit. She was a great host, so there was always, you know, gatherings at her apartment, and you know, she would make, you know, big pots of lasagna, and would always have charcuterie boards and cheeses and wine and stuff. So yeah, I think that's, you know, one of the things that she'll be definitely remembered by.
Yeah. So do you want to speak about Laurie Frink, who you studied mm-hmm. with? Because she sure. also played in the Maria Schneider Orchestra, and you play with her as well.
Yes. So I play Laurie's chair. Third trumpet in Maria's band. Yeah, Laurie was an absolutely incredible teacher. And at the time, I mean, I studied with her from 2003 to 2005, and I actually moved to New York to study with her. I didn't really know that much about her. So it was a pleasant surprise when I realized how amazing, you know, that she was. So many people talk about her teaching and just the way that she was able to put everyone at ease. And at the same time, she was sort of watching you and like analyzing, you know, what you were doing, and could assign a series of exercises that you would just go away and play, not to think too much about it. And then you would come back the next week and you play it again. And, you know, then she'd assign you you know, maybe the same ones or you know, sort of a progressive exercise. And over time, sort of like your chops would come together. So it was sort of this magic that she was able to do. So she's also very deeply missed. And I've been doing a PhD on her teaching for a few years. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, cross fingers, in the next couple of years, I'll be able to at least release, you know, some of that information. And there's going to be more information released in time in different formats. But step one is sort of just to finish this dissertation on her teaching philosophy and why she taught the way she did and how she taught, you know, not necessarily the exercises themselves.
Yeah, I was just checking my notes because I read something that you were doing research, I think, on her teacher as well, right?
Yes, Carmine Caruso. Yeah, so I've discovered all this fantastic information, but for an actual dissertation, it's too much to talk about.
Okay.
So I've had to keep. I mean, it's changed so many times over the last couple of years. But but I certainly can't talk about Laurie's teaching without talking about her mentor, Carmine Caruso.
You know, our principal trumpet player in my orchestra is Karen Donnelly, and actually, she was one of my first guests on this podcast. And I said, "Oh, I'm interviewing Nadia Nordhaus. Do you know who she is?" She said, "Well, of course."
Oh, well, that's lovely. That's lovely to hear. I always just sort of think of myself as like a third or fourth trumpet, so I'm always sort of surprised if people have heard my name.
Well, in the brass world, as someone, you know, you're known mostly as a jazz musician, but you definitely bridge different styles and also as a pedagogue and frankly as a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think sort of being able to do each of these things, I think, is great in order to sort of keep a career interesting. And they all complement each other, these different facets. So yeah, it's. I mean, I've just essentially followed my nose, so to speak, and I feel like each of these different areas of my life, whether it's playing or composition or teaching, just it seems to come in waves. Like certain years, I'll play more. Certain years, I'll write more. And then certainly, I'm sort of like in a teaching and a research phase at the moment, so I'm not looking to, you know, book tours of my own music or anything like that right now. I'm sort of a little bit underground, as well as working on, you know, three records. but certainly, yeah, just trying to juggle all these different projects. And you know, I wouldn't say I'm very successful at juggling that with any sort of balance or consistency, but I'm doing what I can.
Yeah, I mean, so many people I talk to think about sort of the seasons of the cycles of work or life. I think sometimes it can't be like every day, but it could be a block of weeks or months or years, even when you do so many different things.
Yeah.
But you do still play with the Anat Cohen Tentet, and you just were touring with them.
Yes. We were just in San Francisco, and then, yeah, just like an hour away at a university. And before that, we were working on a collaboration with an organization that works with blind and visually impaired people. So that was really fascinating.
That was my next question about
that.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, so essentially we'd, Odette Levary, who's the musical director, had written some music for us, some new music for us. And so we were rehearsing that, as well as going into a place called Visions. And so we would play in front of a blind and visually impaired audience and then get their feedback on what they were hearing or what they would like to hear or what they, you know, what they would like or what they don't like. So it was really incredible, actually.
Mm-hmm. It might be interesting to talk about your childhood in Australia. Mm-hmm. So I understand as a very young child, you were already teaching piano to some other little kids before school.
I know, it's a little bit ridiculous to when I look back at it, but yeah, like I started playing piano very early. There was a piano in the house, and I just sort of, you know, crawled up and thought this was fun. And You know, I've got very supportive parents, luckily, and so my mum enrolled me in a Yamaha music school, and there I had an incredible piano teacher. She was absolutely just wonderful. She was like a second mom, really, to me. So I played piano, classical piano, and then. In third grade, there was a program in Australia where every public school student learns a band instrument. So my piano teacher's husband played the trumpet. So that's why I picked the trumpet. And so I just, because I'd had years of piano training, then I was like, oh, this is, I've just got to read one staff at a time. This is easy. So I think my band teacher was like, can you help some other students? So I had five students before school. Like every day I had a student, like for half an hour. I think I had three piano and two trumpet or something like that. I can't quite remember. And then I had a recorder class of second graders when I was in sixth grade. I would go over to the other school and teach this class. So I've taught from a very young age, and then that became sort of my job. So instead of working, you know, at a chicken shop or something, I just taught lessons, and that's how I got my pocket money together.
I heard that the very first time you picked up a trumpet, you were able to play a C major scale, which is very unusual.
Yeah, and I mean I can't give myself any credit for that. I wasn't, you know, it's just something that I was able to do, just like some people can, you know, do backflips or something, you know, you know, or run fast. I just was able just to sort of, yeah, play through. And I remember my sound as well, like it was actually more mellow, but I liked, yeah, I sort of like the sound aspect of it was something that was just like an immediate thing. So it was just sort of something that happened quite naturally, not as, you know, as a result of any intelligence or hard work or anything. Mm-hmm. But certainly building on that over the years was the challenge. But it was great just to have that octave.
So I was wondering if you'd be willing to share. I do understand you had stopped playing trumpet for many years, mm-hmm. and you had some bad experiences with sexism, mm-hmm. Before you left Australia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I never wanted to be a trumpet player. but the reason why I didn't is because I never saw myself represented in the music. Like I never saw women perform and thought, oh, I could do that. In fact, I was in my first or second year of my production degree. So I was going to be a sound engineer and a producer. That there was an all-female jazz quintet came to this small town, and they had to sort of move the pool table to in this pub to fit the band in. And I remember just thinking, oh, I didn't know we could do that, you know. Even though I'd played in my high school jazz band, and you know, we had some great gigs and did some things, but I never, you know, every. And that was a predominantly, you know, it was like majority female, big band, three out of the five trumpets, all female trombone section, three out of the five saxes. So it was sort of normal for me to see, you know, sort of on a high school level, but certainly professionally, you know, it was a completely different story. So it wasn't until I'd seen this band, I thought, oh, I didn't know that was a thing. And I think just that memory was just sort of in the back of my mind. So when my production, my efforts in production, you know, I just sort of hit a glass ceiling pretty hard. You know, the only job that I could get was distributing radio commercials through phone lines. That was like the big technology of the time. And so I ended up getting fired from that job because the main producer was leaving, and I assumed after working there 18 months that I would take his place, but they hired another man, and I was told that the the people on the board didn't think a woman could run a studio. So that's, and I was livid. I can't remember ever being that angry. And for days too. But I went over to a friend's place for coffee and cake, as one does after being fired for being a woman. I thought, what am I going to do? And she said, well, why don't you move to Melbourne and study improv? I'm like, oh, that's a great idea. I'll move in a month. And that's what I did, a month to the day. I packed up my car. I'd never been to Melbourne, and it was a 12-hour drive. But but I moved, and I moved like 7 months before the audition. So it was pretty confident. But I only knew two jazz records, and so I just played along with them. I never thought of like taking a lesson or anything. luckily I got in, and then it was many years of trying to catch up. I just felt like I was running behind the bus. I didn't know who anyone was. I played by ear. I couldn't read chords. I couldn't transpose. I was like, what am I doing? So it was a lot of hard work and a lot of crying. at least in the first year, but you know, I'm pretty determined. So if I start something, I'll finish it, even if it's, you know, not the most graceful thing you've ever seen.
So those two records you were playing along with, one was Miles Davis?
Yes, Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, and the other one was Dave Brubeck, Time Out.
So you were essentially transcribing the solos without realizing that's what you were doing?
I think I was just playing over the top of them.
Okay.
I never transcribed what they played. I just used it as a sort of like a harmonic basis for my own sort of meanderings.
So when you went into the audition, what did you actually play?
So I played Take Five. That was one of them. And I don't even think I really realized it was in five. Like, I, you know, there was some gaps in my knowledge.
Instinct.
It was 99% instinct and 1% luck. I think, or maybe the other way around, actually. I can't remember the other tunes I played. I think there was at least three, but I can't remember what they were. I just remember Take Five, because I look back and I'm like, wow, if I knew it was in five, I probably wouldn't have played it.
So at the Victorian College of the Arts in Melbourne, you did get some good guidance, because you did get into Manhattan School after that.
I did. Yeah, I remember just after about sort of 6 months of in my mind, sort of, you know, I was chasing the bus that everyone else was on. I asked a teacher, what's the fastest way that I can catch up and learn everything? And he said, transcribe. Mm-hmm. So I went to the library every day for an hour, for at least a year. And, you know, I didn't know who anyone was, so I would just pick random CDs off the shelf. Sometimes it was classical percussion, or sometimes it was saxophone, or, you know, I just sort of really went quite random on it. The first one I did, though, I remember it was Miles, because I'd heard of him. And I think it took me an hour to transcribe maybe 8 bars, and he probably played 4 notes or something, you know. But I also didn't realize that a lot of people transcribe with their instrument. But I was obviously in the library, and trumpets aren't exactly encouraged there. But my ears had already been pretty good because of, you know, all the ear work that I'd done over the years, plus some sort of, you know, natural ability that I can't take credit for. So, so I would just sort of write it out, and then eventually I would learn. It took me a while to be able to hear what the other instruments were doing other than melody. I was always very melody driven. So it just took me, I'd have to listen to it. I'm going to listen just to the piano. And then I listened again. I'm just going to listen to the bass. Okay, I'm just going to listen to the drums. So I would just like listen to things on repeat and really try and isolate, you know, what each part was doing. And so, yeah, we'd write them out and then we'd try and write out the chords. And then we'd try and write out like trying to sort of analyze as best I could, like, what are they doing? You know, what are the chord tones? What are not the chord tones? How are they getting from chord to chord and that kind of thing? So that was very helpful. Very, very helpful. Highly recommended.
Wonderful. I have to say, I love all your albums and I've listened to them so much, but your album Full Circle, I think, might be my favorite.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear.
It's such a special album.
Oh, thank you.
So this is not on your record label, your label, no. Little Mystery Records.
Right. Yeah, it will be. Okay. but yeah, so it's on Nouvelle Records at the moment for 5 years. And so, yeah, that's been an amazing label to be on. Ilan Mela runs that label and he does such creative and wonderful work. He asked me to record and he said that you could record as soon as next week is what he said. And I said, well, are there any other dates that I could pick? and he kept asking, and I said, what's the furthest date? Because I was actually going on tour for 6 weeks. So there was a date essentially 2 days after I get back, and I'm like, that's the one. I'll take that one. So while I was on the road, I was just like searching old sort of voice messages that I'd sort of, you know, I usually write at the piano. I just sort of like improvise and record things and then go back and like, is there anything here? So I was on this tour where we would be in a van for 9 hours a day. So I'd just be working on charts and trying to put it all together. So that was, you know, I knew that I had to be very organized, because I would have one rehearsal and then just this one afternoon they were going to mix it the next day. So there wasn't a whole lot of room for error. So, and it's also, it was for vinyl too. So I've got time restraints too. So just working out which tunes were going in what order and on what side of the record and solo order, like, really planning things much more than I usually would. So that's how that all came about.
So it's a quartet album and the pianist is Fred Hirsch, so great. Mm-hmm. Had you worked with him a lot before that?
I worked with him on his Leaves of Grass project. So I played in his ensemble and I knew him, you know, I'd known him for about 20 years at that point, you know, through friends, and would always go to his gig at the Vanguard. And I was lucky enough to play in his Leaves of Grass project. You know, we had some tours. I don't play on the original record, but I did gigs that I think the original trumpet player couldn't do. So that was amazing with Kurt Elling and Kate McGarry. So that was wonderful just to be on stage with all these monsters. I remember we were playing at Lincoln Center and I'm just sort of looking around at everybody going, oh, this is nice. I need to remember this moment.
I've heard you speak on other interviews about your experiences at Manhattan School when you were really poor and really struggling financially and how hard it was. Are you willing to share about that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I'd moved over from Australia with what I thought was enough money, you know, through grants and some family assistance. I thought I'd have enough for a couple of years, but I think I got a bit too excited about being in New York, and I sort of blew through it all in like 7 months or something. So then I'm like, oh no, what am I going to do? So as an international student, I could only work at the school for 20 hours a week. So I worked as an usher and then eventually stage manager, and I could do some teaching through the school as well. So, you know, I was really living on, it was like $200 a week, you know, which is for New York, you know, that's like, especially now, I don't know if that would be possible, but I ended up living in a place that was very cheap, but it also had some friends, some little creatures, that would often visit and stay, and and I just, you know, I just had to really, I'd been in when I was studying my first degree, I thought that I would move up there and then I would get a job locally, you know, and be able to support myself that way. But in this little country town where I was in, there was like no jobs. So I ended up having to keep going to Sydney and then, you know, worked in a supermarket and laser tag and saved up all my money. And then that's what I would live on for the rest of the year. So I was very used to sort of operating with very low overheads and budgeting and things like that. So that experience really helped me when I was trying to, you know, be able to do my finances in New York. You know, what was that, six years later? Something like that, maybe a few more. So yeah, it was a tough time. Yeah, I ate a lot of rice and beans. There was a Cuban Chinese place across the street, so I think it was like $2 or $3, and that would be a couple of meals and a lot of porridge. So I don't like oatmeal now. I don't like it. I find it very triggering. So those were some tough years, and then just really busy at school trying to get all my work done and then also work at the school. Like, I think I probably averaged about 4 hours of sleep a night, you know. So when I had finished the degree, I'm like, I'm done. I want to earn some money. I'm sick of being so poor. And so I ended up working at the school as a program coordinator for the distance learning department. And that included the recording studio. So it's sort of like this production thing always sort of never went too far away. Those were some tough times. Made me strong.
I was just thinking, I mean, do you think Lori or other teachers realized how bad it was for you? Like,
I'm sure I never mentioned it.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be something that I mentioned. However, I did mainly talk in my lessons with Lori. So it was almost like a therapist rather than a trumpet teacher. But that was exactly what I needed at that time, like to be able to sort of cope with everything that was going on. So, you know, she was all about teaching the individual. So certainly sort of providing a space for me to vent was more important than flexibility exercises at that particular point. Although she did give them to me, so I knew what they were. Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not I did them was another thing. But
So you did start playing again, and then I understand you couldn't break through that glass ceiling again as a trumpet player.
Yeah, it was always kind of, you know, I was just thinking of like head scratching. Like, I'm like, what is going on? Because the only people that hired me were all women bands, and that wasn't something that I was used to in Australia. So yeah, so I played in with Sherry Miracle and the Diva Jazz Orchestra. So I played with them for about 10 years, and I played in a club date band run by Kit McClure. And so that was based on the International Sweethearts of Rhythm, you know. So, yeah, it was just sort of... I wasn't sure what was going on, and then I also wasn't sure whether or not, you know, it was ever going to work out for me being able to stay in the States and play music. And I wasn't even particularly sure of my own musical goals, other than I just wanted to play music and travel around and have fun. So yeah, it wasn't until 2007, I think. So it was like 2 years after I graduated when Darcy James Argue asked if I could sub on a rehearsal. And I was like, this is my big break. Like, you know, if I'm seen to be playing in a band run by a man, it's going to give me some credibility. And that's what happened, you know, which is super weird. And it's not something that I believe would happen today. The scene is very different now than it was sort of pre-Me Too. To me, there's the there's a clear line of sort of, you know, pre-2017 and post-2017. Yeah, I think that was the time when, you know, it was more likely that people would look around and go, oh, half the population's missing. That's weird. Maybe we should do something about it, you know, rather than, you know, just not thinking about it and hiring their mates, you know.
I'm curious in terms of the pipeline, because you said in high school there were all these women in the jazz band.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
Like at Manhattan, when you did your master's, what was the division like gender-wise?
There was one other woman. When I started, there was another woman, a drummer, and she made it through one class and quit. And I was so upset. I was like, oh no, then it's just me, you know. In the whole year. And then in second semester, there was a transfer student who's a Korean pianist, Mi Jong Lim. And so we became very, very good friends. And we actually just made a record that's just come out. So these friendships are long lasting, you know. But so then it was just the two of us, and there was a vocalist as well. So I'm sorry, in my mind I'm always talking about instrumentalists, but there was a woman vocalist there as well. So yeah, it was all just quite odd to me, because coming, you know, I mean, I went to a, you know, VCA in Melbourne was a small program, I think maybe around 20 people in the year, but I would say maybe five or six, you know, were women. So I was the only trumpet player, so it wasn't weird. No one was like, oh, you're a woman, that's weird to play the trumpet. Like, it would be more likely, like, why are you playing jazz? That's weird, you know. You know, it's very, you know, Australia's very into their pub rock, where I came from, especially. So it was just like, I just felt I'd time traveled. I'm like, oh, I'm back in the 50s. I'm like, where's my apron? You know, like, it was very odd. Weird.
So actually, a fairly large percentage of my listeners live in Australia. I've had several Australian guests. So people, especially there, will be interested. Where did you grow up? What part of the country?
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes. I've linked directly to this one in the show notes, with jazz trombonist Naomi Moonsiegel, Australian artist, composer, and curator Lawrence English, Dutch jazz singer and pedagogue Ineke van Doorn, and jazz violinist Sarah Caswell, among so many episodes since 2021. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. In the show notes, you'll also find a link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get exclusive information about upcoming guests, a link for my Ko-fi page to support this project directly, where you can buy me one coffee or every month, and my podcast merchandise store. You can also review this podcast, share it with your friends, and follow on your podcast app, YouTube, and social media. All this helps. Thanks. Now, back to my conversation with Nadia.
So I grew up in Sydney, and in this part of Sydney, we sort of identify ourselves by our closest beach. So I would say I'm from Manly, which is, you know, Manly Beach, which is just down the road. And it's part of the northern beaches of Sydney, so it's north of the Harbour Bridge. And in this area, I just grew up in sort of like a middle class, you know, the middle class suburbs, but there was a lot of music going on, and especially like the schools that I went to had really fantastic music programs. Especially my high school program had some fantastic teachers, and one in particular was the conductor of the jazz bands and the concert bands, and everything I learned about ensemble playing, I learned between grades 7 and 9. You know, high school in Australia is grade 7 through 12. So, and he was also my trumpet teacher. So I learned a whole lot in a very sort of concentrated few years, and those are sort of the skill sets that I ended up drawing on sort of a decade later. But there's a local jazz festival, the Manly Jazz Festival. That was my first gig in sort of fourth grade, sort of playing When the Saints, you know, sort of walking down the street. And I got a Swatch watch for that. So I was like, oh, music business, lucrative. So there's always music, but there's also, you know, like rock and, you know, like the rock band INXS, like, went to my high school. Like, Michael Hutchins was in a neighboring school, but there's like Midnight Oil and sort of like, so that there's, it's a very musical little section of the world.
I was surprised to hear that you started band instruments in grade 3. Would mm-hmm. that be like at the age of 9?
7.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. 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 So yeah. So I was 7. I know in the States, and I suppose too, when I was teaching band programs, it was grade 5. So people were more like 10 or something when they did it. But you know, when in the early 80s, it was third grade. So. It was okay.
Yeah, I'm in Canada, so I played the oboe in band, but mm-hmm. we didn't have band till grade 7 when you were teenagers. But I just can't imagine a little 7-year-old holding a clarinet or, you know.
Yeah.
French horn.
right. Yeah, I mean, my sister was a trombone player and her arms weren't long enough to reach 7th position, so she'd kick it down to her foot and then kick it back up.
Wow.
You know, like kids are, you know, they'll find a way. Yeah, there was low brass. I mean, you know, there's, you know, maybe in the concert. I mean, there was a concert band, so it would be grades 3 to 6. So there would always be, you know, sort of like bigger kids to play larger instruments. But yeah, for trumpets, I think there was 11 trumpet players. In fact, in fourth grade, they're like, we've got too many trumpet players, but we don't have a bass clarinet. Will you play bass clarinet? So for a year, that's what I did, but I wasn't into it, and then I ended up, you know, back in the trumpet section.
So you have a teaching job now at Lawrence University in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was wondering if that landscape reminds you of Australia at all, like.
Well, right now it's covered in snow, so yeah. it looks very different to the beach, which I'm sort of used to. No, to me it just looks like a movie, you know. around the Midwest, and there's like these large open like cornfields and farms. I'm like. You know, in my head, I'm always hearing like Bill Frisell, you know, and and Pat Metheny, or I'm just thinking that, like, I'm a character in, like, an indie movie, you know. I like to, you know, sort of think about that. You know, I think I read somewhere it's nice to sort of imagine yourself as a main character in a movie. Sometimes that can sort of explain away sort of the madness. I've been here. Yeah, this is my second year. Living in Wisconsin. However, I'm only really here maybe half the year. Mm. I do travel around and play with different ensembles, and sometimes do like guest artist work with local big bands, and local to them, not so much local to me. I'm essentially just traveling from a different airport, but just one with 10 gates rather than 100. It recently expanded. It was 5. Last year it was 5 gates. This year is 10. So, you know, it's moving up in the world.
And your students play different styles of music, right? It's not just jazz or...
Yeah. So it's a mix of genres, mix of majors. So a lot of my students play in, say, orchestra and jazz band, which I really like, because I like to teach the trumpet. You know, it's the same notes. I keep saying, especially if, you know, it's usually if people have had a lot of classical training, sort of the thought of improvisation or jazz phrasing is quite intimidating. So I do try and make it a little bit more accessible by reminding them, I'm like, it's the same notes. Like, you know, you just got to phrase it a little. It's just different articulation, you know. So I really like that about Lawrence, is that, you know, they can play whatever style they like. So often in the recitals, they're covering a lot of genres. It's quite unique in that way, I think.
Do you want to talk about your group, Fifth Bridge? Are you still involved with them?
Mm-hmm.
It's an unusual ensemble.
Yeah. So Fifth Bridge is, a five-piece trumpet ensemble. It's an electroacoustic ensemble, and the pieces that we play are commissioned for the group. So we're just about done with our debut recording, and weirdly they're all sort of like space themed. I don't know, that was never an intent, but maybe when people hear trumpets and electronics, they're immediately thinking sort of like celestial sounds. I think that's what it is. All very angelic. like we're known to be. So that's been super fun. So we've got a mixture of sort of classical and jazz professors. All of us are teaching full time, and so when we can get together, you know, we're playing these commissions. So I've been in the band the shortest amount of time, so just a couple of years. It's super fun to sort of hang out with other trumpet players and electronics and make weird sounds and try and work out how to play difficult music.
Cool. I wanted to also mention your Gullfoss album, which I believe you recorded in Switzerland. And Maeve Gilchrist is on harp.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like unusual because you have like Jesse Lewis on guitar. And actually James Shipp is on that, right, with percussion. Mm-hmm. And so it's such a neat sound. And do you want to talk about that project?
Sure. Yeah, the album Gullfoss came about because there was a Swiss promoter that came to a gig that I was playing at the 55 Bar. And he said, you know, if you're ever in Europe, come by and play at my club. And I'm like, okay. So he would email like, yeah, every 6 months or so. And like you coming to Europe? I'm like, no. And then eventually he's like, do you want to come to Europe and make a live record? I'm like, yes. So I had to think what sounds do I want, you know, on vinyl. Like, I was very much sort of like, you know, the sort of stereotypically much warmer sounds. Thinking of sort of the storytelling aspect of like, what story can I tell in 20 minutes? And then they've got to, you know, go flip the record, and then what happens? You know, so sort of making those sorts of creative considerations as well. So I remember having a hard time trying to work out the band to put together. And I think it was my sister who just said, well, who are your favorite people to play with? And I'm like, well, James and Jesse and Ike and Maeve. And then she's like, okay, all right, leave me alone. Like, I'm at work, you know? Like, I'm like, okay. So then I just wrote music for them. So I think it's lovely to be able, it's sort of like a luxury, really, to be able to write music and knowing that I can just put a lead sheet together and then they will add their stamp on it. So we played three nights in this club. Musique Flaggy Dark is the name of the club in Muri, Switzerland. And so we would just play the one set, and then, you know, then I would record it and listen to it, and then we'd sort of make some tweaks and changes, and then do the same set the next night. And so the record is mostly the last night. Okay. I think there was maybe just one tune that was like, you know, from a different night. But I remember being quite worried that the sound wouldn't be as good as a regular studio record, but I needn't have worried because they had fantastic gear and fantastic engineers, and yeah, so it was great. Yeah, it was a really, really fun project.
Your engineering training must affect the way you come into recording spaces.
It really does. Like, I'm always thinking about sound, and I think the hardest thing for me is to listen back to my own sound, because often what I hear is not what other people hear, because I'm behind the bell. So that's been a sort of like a tough thing to sort of grapple with over the years. But just finding engineers that I, you know, especially that I feel like can capture my sound well, like, that's just so important. I will arrange my schedule around being able to work with certain engineers. And working out what mics and the placement and all that kind of thing. I love making records. That's what I wanted to do. So it's sort of, you know, being, you know, I think when I was imagining what I wanted to do when I was a teenager, I never thought of myself as being the musician that I was recording, you know. So that's been a wonderful surprise to be like, oh, it was me all along. How about that? You know, I just, you know, I never thought that was possible. So that's been really lovely. It's always an area that, like, I wish I knew more, you know, and sometimes it's sort of hard, you know, if I'm wanting a certain thing, to be able to explain that in a studio setting is such a skill set. And sometimes it's, you know, I'm just... I remember working with an engineer, and I couldn't say, oh, you know, it's this frequency that I want a little bit more, or how many dB or that. I was just more like whoa, you know, like trying to use some syllables to try and explain. He's like, oh yeah, okay, I gotcha, you know. So it's always a work in progress, but you know, I think that's why I love music on the ECM record label so much, is just because it's so magnificently recorded, and such sort of pristine sound, and even just the details, like those few seconds of silence before the music starts on track one, you know. And that's why I mean, Jan Erik Kungshaug is the engineer that recorded 90% of the 99% maybe. Of ECM's catalog, and you know, as much as, you know, I've always wanted Manfred Eicher to call me, I haven't got that call yet. So I'm like, well, if I can't be on the label, maybe I could still get the sound. So I remember emailing Jan Erik saying, would you like to mix my record? And he's like, sure. And I'm like, wow. So that was my first record. So, you know, I was in Europe with Darcy James Argue, and then tacked on a few extra days and popped over to Oslo with this massive hard drive. Yes, and, you know, because, you know, the hard drives that, you know, like this big, but yeah, wasn't the case back in 2010. So yeah, so he mixed my first record, which was very exciting, and then he also mixed my record with Luke Howard, the duo called Ten Sails, which has sort of had a life of its own.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. That you recorded in Berlin, and
yes,
so he's a well-known Australian composer. And
yes, Luke. Yes, he's a really beautiful piano player and composer. And yeah, we went to VCA together. So. But we never played music together at that time. I think we were friends for about 15 years, where we're like, oh, maybe we should do a gig. and I remember turning up, and we're like, oh wait, some of our music's got the same chord changes, and you know, we played, and we're like, oh, we kind of can't tell whose tunes are whose, like our aesthetic was so similar. So he was living in Berlin at the time, and said, oh, if you're ever over here. I'm like, well, actually, I'm gonna be over there, you know, at the end of the year or whatever it was. And apparently Luke said, I was just saying that. He tells me later, but I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll come over and record. He's like, oh, okay, well, all right then. So again, putting tunes in a Dropbox, and then, yeah, rehearsed for a couple of days, and then yeah, recorded for a couple of days, and it was just this one, it was in someone's apartment, and it was just one room, and his piano had an extra layer of felt, like all the sort of the cabinetry was off, so you could just see the mechanics, and it was very close mic, so you can hear, it's a very sort of intimate sound, and I was like, oh, I don't know how this is going to go with a trumpet. So there was a baffle between us, so we couldn't actually see each other. And I was playing this the softest I'd ever played in my life, and which is exhausting. It's really, really exhausting. And just like listening to the sound in such a detailed way that I'm like, oh, like if I was playing flugel, I'm like the articulations need like a little bit more definition. So I'm going to use a trumpet mouthpiece in the flugel, just to give it a little bit of something. So often, like, the sounds that I recorded, people are like, is that trumpet or flugel? I'm like, I can't really tell you. I don't remember, but also if it's flugel, it could have a trumpet mouthpiece. Or if it's I don't know if I recorded any trumpet with a flugel mouthpiece, but there could have been, you know. So I was just trying to make it sound okay. And I think at the end of the 2 days, I had to lie on the floor. Like, I was just absolutely exhausted. And then I also had to play quite loudly until Luke said, can you stop? I just needed like a cleanse, you know? But weirdly, sort of from that point forward, I feel like it opened up this whole section of my playing, where suddenly my dynamic range was this rather than just this, you know. So being able to sort of play and sort of get entrances really clean at an incredibly soft volume was sort of this unexpected skill set that I never knew I needed, you know. But it certainly came in handy, even sort of on records like Multitudes, you know. It was that same sort of approach, you know, just playing, you know, sort of with as much control as I can at a very soft volume.
What are your feelings about trips back to Australia and life as an immigrant?
Yeah, I think it's hard as I think of myself as an expat. You know, I think that's sort of the category that I put myself in. Yeah, it's a weird place to be, because when people say where's home, I'm like, well, my immediate answer is Sydney. You know, Sydney will always be my home, you know, and I have my childhood home. and that's, you know, likely where I will return to at a certain point. So, yeah, I like to think of myself as on a very long working vacation. So when, you know, I mean, I lived in New York for 21 years, and I moved out of Australia when I was 26. So it's, you know, and I've lived in Wisconsin my second year. So it's sort of getting to the point now where I've almost been away, you know, for as long as I lived in Australia. But and not that I want to sort of separate myself from my identity as an Australian person. it's this weird thing that, like, I'm never like, oh, this is my home forever and ever, you know. This is always like, oh, this is where I am right now, and I like it, and there's good people and stuff. So I think it's yeah, it's sort of like a state of being that I'm very used to at this point. Yeah. I was raised in a family of very strong, independent women, you know, and my dad, you know, who's also very strong and independent, you know, but certainly I was surrounded by many, many women. I was sort of like an extended family sort of, you know, situation, you know, at home, which was wonderful, you know, just really lucky to have that. So that has always sort of just been my default. And so it doesn't seem unusual to me. And to just sort of have an idea and to go for it, not thinking of, oh, society doesn't want me to do that, therefore I shouldn't, or whatever. Like, there was never any sort of considerations like that, you know, and that's why I think sort of hitting glass ceilings was such a surprise, because it had never dawned on me, you know, and especially, you know, and that's, you know, obviously happened in different, you know, different fields. So, I think it was a really lovely way to be brought up. Basically sort of like you can do what you want. And that's always like my advice. You know, sometimes if you know, I'm working in a, you know, elementary school or something, they're like, oh, do you have any advice? I'm like, yeah, do what you want. And they're like, no, don't say that, you know. But I'm like, yeah, but like, you know, big picture, like, I don't want you to be sort of, you know, stuck doing someone else's taxes if you want to, you know, want to be doing something else, you know, with your life. So I just, you know, and I think that's obviously sort of operating from this sort of place of extreme sort of privilege, where I've, you know, always had this sort of backup net, you know, of like, well, if it doesn't work out, I can just go home, you know. So I've always had that, you know, and, you know, I've got a great family. And so it's like, I've never felt like if this doesn't work out, like, I'm going to be on the street, you know, like, you know, so that sort of, that freedom has sort of like allowed me to take more risks than, you know, maybe seems like a good idea, you know, but to me, I'm like, oh, I'll just give it a go, you know. Oh, that didn't work out. Okay, well, we'll find something else, you know, so yeah.
Well, thank you so much for this today, Nadia.
You're most welcome. Thanks so much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Keep in mind, I've also linked directly several episodes you'll find interesting in the show notes of this one. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.